Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Cheese State University. Cheese State University was created for dedicated cheese professionals seeking to deepen their knowledge, sharpen their skills, and build connections. Join them in the Ivy League of cheese education at cheesestateuniversity.com.
Welcome to Inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast of the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. I'm your host, Todd Shulkin, the Foundation's Executive Director. Our show takes you inside the Foundation's world to meet the talented people we have the great fortune of learning from all the time. On today's show, we welcome wine expert John Bonnet. In this episode, we'll talk to John about the new French wine, which is also the title of his new book, and we'll hear John's Julia moment. Stay with us. We'll be right back. As always, we launch the conversation with an inspiration from Julia. Julia's advocacy for wine drinking is legendary, as are the untrue rumors that she was drunk on TV. If that's your impression, you're confusing Dan Aykroyd's Saturday Night Live parody with real life. Julia couldn't slice and dice with speed and accuracy while on camera and be drinking real wine. What Julia learned in France was an appreciation of wine, when and how to drink it, and an awareness that good wine comes from good agronomy. What tends to get lost in much of the pretense surrounding wine collecting is that making good wine is rooted in good farming. It starts with growing good grapes. Now, like with French food, Julia's goal was to demystify Americans' understanding of French wine. In the 1960s, when she first started advocating for its merits, French wine was viewed as something only for sophisticates. But her goal was to democratize French wine drinking. Julia said, "I say fie to those onophilic spoil sports who insist that wine goes with neither eggs nor salads. Wine is essential with anything, particularly omelets for lunch." Someone who shares Julia's mission to keep expanding our preconceptions about French wine and actually probably knows what an onophilic spoil sport is John Bonnet. John is currently the managing editor of Resy and previously was the wine editor and chief wine critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. Prior to that, he was a lifestyle editor and wine columnist for MSNBC, the U.S. columnist for Decanter Magazine, and the wine consultant for JetBlue Airways. His work has earned him 3 Roederer Awards, the most ever won by an American, including for his groundbreaking book, The New California Wine. He's also the author of The New Wine Rules, which has been published in multiple international editions. John has been a journalist for more than 3 decades, including work in digital journalism for outlets such as NBC News, Court TV, and News Corp. He joins us today to tell us all about his new comprehensive 2-volume book, The New French Wine, Redefining the World's Greatest Wine Culture. Welcome to the podcast, John.
Hey, Todd. It is a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. So let's just start with the obvious question. Why does French wine need redefining?
Well, I don't know if that makes me an enophilic spoil sport to suggest it.
But, to some, probably.
So the reason I would say it needs redefining is that French wine as it exists today is radically different than it was even 20 years ago. It's you know, same but different. Like it's the same regions, it's the appellations that people know, it's the framework is not fundamentally different than it's been for a very long time, although not as long as people would imagine. But the ways in which these wines are made, the quality, to your point about agronomy, the farming, the understanding of ripeness and climate change, the quality revolution that really has taken place in almost every region, these are completely different than they were, let's say, at the turn of the millennium, when the wine world overall, and certainly the French wine world, was very different. The tastes that people had were very different. The approach to farming, the view of what ripeness was, of what style was, all of these things are truly remarkably changed in a couple decades.
I want to pick up on that because actually I think you just made a great point that gets maybe lost in the shuffle of the pretense of French wine is there's plenty of French wine that's mediocre or bad or just like box wine here. Just a lot of it wasn't exported. And I think that's what you're talking about is actually the overall quality of average French wine has gone up quite a bit, or there's more good wine than there used to be. Or do you disagree with that?
Well, you know, the overall quality of wine everywhere has gone up dramatically versus what it was 30 years ago. And some of that is just is kind of the end of the life cycle of a proper enological training and viticulture, things like that. In fact, what I would say is it's more that the bad French wine has increasingly gone away, which is to say the wines that are not farmed particularly well, that are made for bulk wine, that are really made on the cheap, that don't represent the greatness of French terroir or French wine in general, there's ever less of that, in part because it's just not economical for the French to make it anymore. It's a country with very high labor standards. It's a country that, leaving aside obviously its historical role in making great wine, wine is an important part of the culture, but it is consumed less than it was 20 or 30 years ago. And if you really want that, you know, kind of cheap supermarket wine, and the French, you know, or French farmers, some of them will literally take to the streets over this. Spain can do it cheaper. Italy can do it cheaper. There's lots of places in the world that you can get cheap wine, all of which, to be fair, is much better than it used to be. But to some extent, that part of the French industry keeps falling out because it just doesn't make economic sense. There's no real value to being a farmer who just turns his grapes into the co-op to make indistinguishable cheap wine.
Because ultimately, there's not enough profit in it, is what you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you look somewhere, let's say at Beaujolais, just to take a good example, the bulk grape prices in Beaujolais are what they were 20 years ago. So maybe even less. So if you're thinking about, you know, just being a farmer who doesn't really care quality of the grapes, you're just going to sell them. And that, you know, that was to some extent a view after the Second World War in French agriculture was one of quantity. You simply aren't going to survive because, you know, There's very few things that that have the same price that they did 20 years ago. So you're getting paid what you did two decades ago. Your farming costs have gone up. Your labor costs have gone up. It's hard to say that there's actually even a market for grapes like those anymore. And so it's not sustainable, to your point.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. So let's go back because this is a very
impressive. We got really deep, really fast.
Yeah, I know. And I was like, for all those who thought we were going to talk about wine, they're like, why are we talking about farming still? But I think our mutual point is farming is a big part of making wine that you know, I think for years in sort of the culture of elitism around wine was not discussed, even though it's always been a critical component. I did want to ask you, so this is comprehensive. It's also beautiful. It's more than, I think it's a little hard to calculate, but I said it was more than 800 pages. And that's your, I'm sure not all your work, but edited down to 800 pages. So how long did it take you to put this together? And how did you select the vintners that are included?
So it took about 8 years. This project started in 2014. Yes, it's shockingly, it's I think 864 pages, and that is maybe 75,000 words shorter than it started out, which I still can't get my head around. I don't know where all the words came from. In terms of selecting, you know, that's always the secret sauce. There's no simple answer to it, but I think it was a cross section of certainly the book in terms of producers is broken out by region. So it was knowing that within each region I needed to have, you know, at least a critical mass of vignerons who represented the new and what was happening and what is happening. And, I wanted to try to make sure that I was hitting even some of the more minor appellations that might not be that familiar to folks. But, you know, I wanted to really demonstrate that this range of beliefs in change and in revolution in some cases in terms of quality really is taking place very, very broadly. And you go to somewhere like Saint-Pourçain, which is a very small appellation in the uplands of the Loire as you start to climb into the mountains, not a place that, you know, anyone is clamoring to get wine from. But, you know, it's not a ton of change, but there are people there who are moving to biodynamics and really thinking about serious, intentful winemaking. It was looking at each region, deciding that I needed to try to make, you know, some representative choices, and then looking at who was doing the most interesting work, who were the greatest forces of change, or who were, who were the greatest forces of change, with the asterisk being that doesn't necessarily mean just new wineries. If you look, say, at Burgundy, and there's certain wineries in the producer's volume that are marked as what I call benchmark wineries or domains. And what they are is long established properties that have really done the work. They could easily have just sat back and followed or done what they've always done, but they really took the effort to try and show the potential of what their terroir could offer, even if they already had the fame, that they kept doing the work. And so take Domaine de la Romanée-Conti, which is arguably the most famous Burgundy in the world, certainly the most expensive. And, you know, most of the people who are buying this book, including its author, are probably really never going to drink those wines more than, you know, once in a lifetime, twice in a lifetime. But the work that they have done in terms of introducing biodynamics to the region, in terms of creating genetic diversity in vine selections, in terms of really spreading knowledge and promoting the ambient culture of Burgundy as a place that doesn't just believe in making fancy wine, but believes in making wines at every quality tier, at every price range, or within their spectrum, within every price range. But, you know, they could have easily just gone and been super fancy, and they didn't. They decided to really remain humble and to focus on the work. And so, so even though there's quite a lot of new names in the book, which of course was the point, there are plenty of familiar names because there are sometimes it's the new generations and the kids come in and they really want to kind of get into the game. Sometimes it's just a family that was always more progressive or a domain that was always more progressive. It's this notion of change as an inclusive force. And so I'm not going to say it's a grab bag of producers because it was, you know, 8 years of, you know, choosing people in or out or what have you. But we ended up with a little over 830 producers. And really, I'd say every single one of those, I had to justify to myself why they should be there.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask you, because in some ways, this book is encyclopedic, but it's by no means exhaustive because there are that many vintners in the world and in France. But when you were writing it, or how do you pitch, like, who should buy this book? Is who is it for? Is it for people who already know their Saint-Emilion's from Banyuls, or how do you sort see positioning, or it kind of works on different levels for different readers?
Well, clearly, as an author, I would have to say it's for absolutely everyone, and everyone should have a copy, two or three if they can.
I would say it's very giftable. Yeah. It's both beautiful, and certainly for the wine lover that you know, it makes a perfect gift.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we thought a little about how to make it a good gift book. I think it really and truly works at different levels, and from the beginning, we did conceive it that way and we did structure it that way, which is to say, you know, look, if you're, you know, deep on French wine, if you know it all, or, you know, presume to know it all, none of us know it all. There's lots of very geeky, specific detail. There's lots of discussion of winemaking and viticulture. Hopefully not too, too geeky. I try to, you know, at least, the science writer in me from years past tries to dial it back just a little bit. But, you know, there's, I'm sure there will be people who would like if it went even deeper. But, you know, at some point when you're being published by a commercial and not an academic press, you have to find a balance. But at the same time, you know, it was the same with the New California Wine. I've always found it very, very important to make sure that even if your book is going to serve as a reference, that it have a narrative structure. And so, you know, every region has its own story, somewhat linear. I don't know that I'm ever a linear writer, but it hopefully does tell a tale and tells the tale of why things are changing and how they're changing, introduces you to the vignerons who are behind it and their ideas and their philosophy. And, you know, and this was actually a really valuable learning from writing the first book, was that especially when you get to wine, there has to be an aspect of travel, of voyage, that you are moving through a wine region, you're meeting people, you're discovering what's there, which is to say, you know, there's plenty of philosophical stuff in the book. There's some interstitial chapters that go deep on farming or climate or natural wine, but a lot of the book is really meant to be a journey through France. I mean, my journey through France and discovering all of the things that are changing and all of the people who are behind it.
Well, I think that really comes through. I mean, I've spent quite a lot of time in France without actually technically ever living there over several decades of my life. I thought, you know, I read in particular the regions that I know well, and it all rang true, but I wasn't familiar with any of the producers that you highlighted. So I think you accomplished both your goals very well. I wanted to ask you, I think there's a perception, and you mentioned this at the beginning, that there's maybe more of a deep rooted and fixed, like, ancient history of French wine regions, rather than it actually being a little bit more contemporary than maybe people realize. And so I was curious, how fixed are these regions, and do they change at all?
So it's interesting because the French, of course, love the notion that their wine regions have existed since time immemorial. They are as they have always been. I mean, look, this is what's behind the appellation contrôlée, the appellation system, that these are literally the defining criteria when they were trying to create this was local, longstanding, and constant customs. And so the notion that, say, a Saint-Emilion would be a Saint-Emilion implies that the wine that you get in a Saint-Emilion bottle is as it has always been, and it is made to certain standards, and it represents a certain place and a certain tradition, which is a lovely notion. It's also largely a load of crap, in the sense that, you know, I mean, yes, there is a tradition, and when you look at the real reason the appellations were created, they were created to prevent fraud, and to ensure quality. But you know, the yes, if you believe in the terroir, Saint-Emilion is still largely what Saint-Emilion was. That's an interesting case because they created their own classification in 1955, which has become truly one of the biggest messes in French wine, because what happens when you have ambitious and wealthy people who all want to be at the top of the heap, you know, somebody is going to be unhappy with how that settles out. And when you redo it every 10 years and people have lawyers, it's amazing what happens. But
I think, are you referring to what is the geographic map of what is in the Saint-Emilion appellation?
Not even that, but just the you know, they have Grand Cru and they have, you know, Classe A and B, Class A and B. And so, you know, you want to be not just Grand Cru, but you want to be Class B or Class A, and maybe you're Class A and you get demoted to B, or you B and you want to be A. And so, I mean, there's every single time now since the 80s that a new one is done, somebody sues somebody. Honestly, most of the major estates in Saint-Emilion pulled out of the 2022 classification because they felt that the criteria were no longer relevant. They were being judged for like their social media feed. And they just were like, this
is... Well, I also think what's funny about France is they love a system.
Right.
And they also love gaming a system.
Precisely.
So like both forces are like at their, like I always say, like if you create a system, human beings are engineered to figure out how to work around it. But the French have this duality, right, of loving bureaucracy and bureaucratic systems and being expert at working them.
Yes. And this is quintessentially Cartesian of them. We have all our rules and all our rules are here to break. And so to just to stick with an example, I mean, you could pick lots of appellations. But so if you look at Saint-Emilion, I mean, now people are like, OK, well, it's from this particular area. Area has somewhat changed. What used to be called the Sable de Saint-Emilion, the sands of Saint-Emilion, is now part of the main appellation. The quote unquote Grand Cru of Saint-Emilion, which was supposed to be the top quality, is essentially accounts for the majority of the appellation. So it's not really governing, you know, truly, truly top quality, to your point about gaming the system, and everyone wants to be in it. But more specifically, you know, now if you look at a Saint-Emilion wine, they are predominantly Merlot. There's maybe a little Cabernet Franc. But if you go back to the certainly pre-war, but even the years after the war, the predominant grape in the area was Cabernet Sauvignon and then Cabernet Franc. And it was only after the deep frosts of the 1950s when it was replanted to Merlot. So if you want to talk about constancy, this is literally going from one major grape of Bordeaux to the other major grape of Bordeaux, same appellation, same terroir, theoretically, but they just decided to plant something that had a better ripening curve and ripened earlier and was more productive. Ironically, the sands, they kept more Cabernet on. And now what they're discovering is that climate change is likely going to force them to go back to Cabernet because Merlot gets too ripe too early. And so, again, to this notion of, you know, things never change. Well, things are constantly, constantly changing. And this is why Emile Peynot, who is the great enologist of Bordeaux, his classic line is, tradition is an experiment that worked. And that's so intrinsic to how French wine exists. Like, you know, everything is as it has always been, except we only invented it 5 years ago.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's back to our farming basis for this is growing things is related to nature, and nature has lots of cycles and variations. So something is fixed until it just doesn't bloody work anymore. And then you have to change it, whether that's because you know, climate or disease or something else.
Yeah. And you know, there has been a lot of change of farming that's been forced, which is to say, you know, historically, French viticulture has been predicated on the notion that you will never get your grapes ripe enough, that you're in Northern Europe, things will be too cold, the plants aren't hardy enough, you have hail, whatever it is, like you're never going to get fully ripe grapes. And maybe once once in a decade you do, and then it's, of course, the vintage of the century, as Bordeaux likes to say. But on balance, you're always working with deficiency. And I mean, hundreds and hundreds of years, this has been the supposition. And then really starting in maybe the early to mid 2000s, Vigneron started to realize that this was no longer an issue. And if anything, the opposite was an issue. The harvests had all moved up, often by a month or more. Bud break and other key moments in the growing season had also moved up, which in somewhere like, say, Burgundy was putting the grapes at risk of a killing frost every single year. And so just the cycle of farming that had been in existence for really, again, since certainly the 16th century, if not well before, was being radically disrupted. And, you know, there's places where I think Vigneron were much smarter about it. If you look in the Roussillon, which is really the southernmost part of metropolitan France, of mainland France, the farmers there have for a good couple decades been planting on north-facing slopes, thinking about windbreaks, thinking about how to slow down ripening, because you're almost in Catalonia. There's a lot of sun there. But now their thoughts and their ideas are suddenly having to make their way north to places like Burgundy and even Champagne, where suddenly, you know, this belief that you were at the edge of viable farming for wine is just no longer true. So there's, again, there is this constant change, but also in a more willful and thoughtful way. France historically during the 20th century was one of the countries in the world most reliant on pesticides. And you look at the numbers and it's really astonishing the extent to which they opted into a system that that used enormous quantities of pesticides, herbicides, mildicides, et cetera. And there has been a huge reckoning in French agriculture broadly and French viticulture specifically that this was truly the wrong way to go, that this was profoundly damaging. And there's economic reasons why this was the case, but there's now, I think, a widespread understanding, far more than in the US, that organics is essential, even if it's, you know, you're tweaking exactly how you do it. But certainly making something like wine, that there's this understanding that this is the future. Sustainability in the vague sense, but really going beyond that to specific farming protocols. And so you see, even Bordeaux, which was probably the worst, if not among the worst offenders, you see the percentage of vineyard land that is organic is growing by like double digits every year. And so some of it is the world is changing, you know, the climate is changing, and the French are not immune to that. And even in all their timeless traditions, they have to change. But I think there's also this sense that for scientific reasons, for health reasons, that the methods of farming have to get much better, and that farmers have to learn to make much smarter choices.
Okay, I want to pick up on that after the break, because I think obviously within food and wine, that's a really hot topic. So we'll come back with more from French wine expert John Bonnet. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Cheese State University. Cheese State University was created for dedicated cheese professionals seeking to deepen their knowledge, sharpen their skills, and build connections.
It feels like a gift to be able to give this gift to people, because I know that from my own experiences, I know how valuable, consolidated, incredible training resources are.
They offer an in-depth education on all things cheese, as well as an active network for peer support and career development.
You can pop over to the Quad, which is our social networking and engagement app. And so that's a really fun and dynamic aspect of Cheese State University.
Cheese State's three-part course is designed for seasoned pros and entry-level mongers alike, and covers all the skills one needs to perform on the cheese counter.
The structure of Cheese State University is all based on the Cheese State University Field Guide. And that is a three-volume resource. It's all digital, online.
At the end of the course, students will be ready to ace the field guide assessment and earn their Cheese State Scholar Certificate.
Another resource is a video series where we tackle sort of like these thornier questions that you can get on the cheese counter, like, what is rennet? And like, why is this cheese so expensive? And can pregnant people even eat cheese?
At Cheese State, you're among experts, you're among scholars, you're among cheese lovers, and most importantly, you are a monger. Join them in the Ivy League of cheese education at cheesestateuniversity.com.
Welcome back. We're talking to journalist John Bonnet about his latest book, The New French Wine, Redefining the World's Greatest Wine Culture. So when we went to break, we were talking about organic farming and how that's changing a lot in France, and certainly within even just wine drinking communities. Natural wine, or organic wine, or sometimes called biodynamic wine, or the French word is bio. So you were talking about how this is really transforming the French wine industry. And I was just curious, is it, how widespread is it still, or is it still kind of a niche movement, or it depends which of those many classifications, which sort of mean the same thing but don't, you're talking about?
Yeah, I was going to say the main question there is which of the classifications, because bio or organic and biodynamic or biodynamic mean two different things, but similar things, and natural means something else entirely. In terms of organics, biodynamics is a subset, but you have to be organic to be biodynamic. So let's talk organic. It is relatively widespread. I would have to look at the exact numbers, but if I'm remembering correctly, somewhere around 20% plus of French vineyards are now farmed organically. So that's really extraordinarily high for anywhere in the world. I think in the US, it's maybe 2%, 4%. And you see that number growing rapidly, even for the production of supermarket wine. And some of that is in the French supermarkets, much as you buy organic milk or you buy organic meat, the expectations, even if you're just buying a €4 bottle, that you still are looking for organics. It's part of the culture. The French very strongly believe in buying bio, what for them is bio, across the range of products. So even if you look at somewhere like the Gard, which is where like Arles is, near the Southern Rhone and the Mediterranean. The Gard has something, I think, like 30% plus, maybe up to 40% now, of its vineyards are farmed organically. And these are, for the most part, not vineyards making fancy wine. This is a lot of table wine. So in a broad sense, organics are very clearly the future for French vineyards. And I think you see there, you know, on a widespread basis, whether it's super fancy wines, whether it's, you know, just your, like I said, your €4 bottle in the supermarket, there is a commitment to that. Natural is always a little different. It presumes that, yes, it is organic, biodynamic, what have you, but it's also a lot about process and what is or is not added to the wine, especially commercial yeasts and sulfur dioxide, which is a preservative. And, you know, natural is, there for sure are no numbers around it, and the French are fanatical about maintaining statistics, but I have yet to see real statistics around natural because nobody knows how to define it. Like, every single person has a different definition. But it's, you know, it's, I think on one hand you would say it is a fringe, but this is always my question when someone wants to talk about the mainstream and I ask them to define mainstream. You know, if you look at the serious wine merchants, restaurants, connoisseurs in France, the people who are really deeply involved with the modern wine market, which is to say the top of the gastronomic chain, natural wine is a profound, profound force. It is like in the US and like in, say, Scandinavia, but even more so in France, it is really a guiding force at that top level.
Meaning there's consumer demand or people who are serious about or take their wine drinking seriously are more and more asking for it, exploring it. Is that where it's driven from? Or is it driven from within the industry in a just inherent interest in change?
Both, although I would say it's more wine consumers, and especially wine consumers under 40. And one of the things to really remember when you think about France and its wine culture is it is, well, in their minds, it's a crisis. I don't know if we would consider it a crisis, but there are...
Well, the French like the word crisis.
Yes,
they have a crise de everything.
Yeah, a crise, yeah.
crise de tout.
A crise de Monday, yeah. you know, there are fewer and fewer young French who are drinking wine. It's just, again, you know, it's not something that's seen as an everyday necessity as it once was. And there's, you know, coca, you could drink, you know, you could drink Coke, you could drink kombucha, you could drink all sorts of things. And it's just, it's not quite, it's not as intrinsic to the culture as it was. And so what you do see is the modern culinary movement, what's often called the neo-bistro, or bistronomy, the younger chefs and the restaurants they run, the younger diners, certainly in urban areas, Paris, but in most major cities, they have all transformed their style of cooking. And with that has come a really deep commitment to largely natural wine, certainly to what I would call progressive winemaking in France. And so there's probably less overall wine drinking in general, but the people who are really serious about it, they are actually driving it forward. And there's some interest in the industry, but I think this, you know, when you look at the history of natural wine, it was largely driven by partially the end consumers and partially the restaurants that really supported it in East Paris in the early 80s. And so I think what you see today is just a magnification of something that started a generation or so ago, where there's a desire to shuffle off the very commercial, very industrial winemaking that was that had its rise in the 20th century.
Yeah, no, I think that's interesting. I think you're pointing out that within French culture, there's a lot more. There's the American view of what France is like or was like, and what's depicted in the media or even contemporary television, but that France is going through these really strong transformations in how people live. People are and always have been very health conscious or health. It's not the way we use the word health conscious, concerned about their health, and that has moved toward movements like bio, which is more about food actually and agriculture than it is necessarily about wine. But by extension, that is also changing, but it's also an urban-rural thing. At the same time, the what are called roulets routiers, which are like truck stops, but not exactly, where you used to be able to get great food, now often have terrible food or unhealthy food. And you've got just like in America, these kind of two dichotomies going on at the same time.
You do, although to some extent, the wine culture in rural France, or what they call France périphérique, peripheral France, has largely gone away. People are still drinking some wine there, but it's just these are not affluent areas. They've largely emptied out, and they are, that's just not where wine drinking takes place. And so like almost everything in France that has a dichotomy between the urban, affluent French person and the rural or peripheral France, the wine culture, for better or worse right now, is largely in France being driven by an urban market. Because you go out into the countryside and the kids, as it were, but younger French, they're not sitting in a cafe drinking wine. Like, if anything, they're drinking Desperados, which is sort of a flavored beer, or they're drinking soda or whatever. They're the wine is something their parents drank. And so to the extent that the wine culture in France is pushing forward, it is very much, again, among this kind of young, urbane core of French consumer.
Oh, that is really interesting. Yeah, because most of the time I've spent time in very core wine drinking area or wine growing and wine producing areas. And presumably, I think what you're saying is that's slightly distortive. If you're in a place where wine is a big part of the local economy, there may be more wine drinking still than maybe if you go broader into France in general.
Yeah, although even in a lot of wine producing areas, you don't see a deep wine culture. I mean, you know, if you go to the Rhone and you go to the restaurants that you would expect an American showing up in the Rhone to go to, you will, of course, find good Cote Roti, good Cornas, Cros Hermitage, etc. But, you know, you can also go to a local bar in Tan L'Hermitage and everyone is just going to be drinking beer, or, you know, maybe they're drinking Ricard, although not as much as they used to. But it's just, it's not sort of you wander into a bistro and, you know, everyone is sitting with their beret drinking their Coup de Rouge. Like it's evolved. And my perennial memory of this was I was in Villers-Morgon, which is where the crew of Morgon comes from in Beaujolais. So this is the heart of Beaujolais. This is where the best Beaujolais, in theory, is really from. And I go to the local wine bar, I'll put that in air quotes, wine bar, and you can literally order something like 100 Beaujolais by the glass, and it's basically empty. And it's me who's wandered into my absolute wonderland. I can try like every great Beaujolais that I've ever wanted. It's all there, and you know, and like two kids who are maybe 19 or 20 drinking their Desperados, or actually they were drinking beer flavored with syrup. And because it was like bright green, and that's it. And it's like the three of us sitting in this bar in the heart of Beaujolais, where everyone's like, oh, it's, you know, it's a constant festival and they're drinking their Gamay and it's, you know, it's an endless party. And I like, to be clear, there is one person here drinking Beaujolais. It's the American schmuck who showed up. And the only other people here are drinking flavored beer. And that's basically the tenor of a lot of rural France. It's just, you know, it's not that much different to your point about the, you know, the woutier and local country cooking, where if people are even bothering now, it's all from the metro, which is like the French equivalent of Cisco. And it's all sort of microwaved and, you know, just fast food, basically. And so it's just, you know, this is not to put a dent in the glory of French gastronomy or wine or anything else, but it's just, you know, look, it's a country in 21st century Europe, and it is better now than it had been a few years ago in terms of its economy, but its economy still has some deep issues. And, you know, sitting around the countryside drinking wine is really far down on the list of what most rural French are interested in.
Yeah, no, I'm struck by what you're describing describes America, too. There's a subset of people who are really interested in food and where it comes from and eating at the most interesting places. And there are chefs moving in these exact directions that you describe. But then there's a whole other part of the population that's also just evolved and interested in other things and not spending time on that. I mean, clearly, as much as those of us in the food world obsess about certain things, there's enough frozen food in the grocery store that someone's eating, that there's plenty of people who are not making everything from scratch.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, one of the things that I had to adjust to when I was on the road reporting the book was, you know, I started, well, I'll stay in some lovely little French hotels and I'll go and find little cute little restaurant in whatever town and, you know, and sort of get into the, you know, the vibe of French cooking. And I did that for like a few months. And it was finally in Arbois, which is in the Jura, that it was actually one of the best restaurants in Arbois. And after the third night that I was there, all three nights being served coq au vin jaune, chicken with morels in a cream sauce with vin jaune, which is a specialty wine of the Jura, in June when it's like 90 degrees out. And I was like, I basically was like, can someone find me a salad? anyone. And so after that, I started booking Airbnbs, and I had gotten to a very specific routine. I would go to Leclerc, which is one of the big local supermarkets, and I had my list of like, get Dijon mustard, cornichon, salt, pepper, olive oil, you know, usually, you know, some shallots, things like that. Go to the local farmer's market, pick up fresh produce, pick up some poultry, some cheese, whatever it is. When I was near the ocean, get some seafood. And I would just get into a habit of, you know, probably not the world's most interesting cooking, but just making kind of straightforward, you know, straightforward country food. As much as you want to do for one person who's, you know, staying by themselves in a rental property. But it just became this thing where I was like, the only way that I'm going to make it through the years it's going to take to do this thing is if I stop with believing I'm going to find these great local restaurants everywhere, stop eating all the microwaved whatever, and just do what, to your point, France does well, which is grow remarkable raw product at astonishingly affordable prices. People often forget the extent to which agriculture and thus food prices are subsidized in France, and just, you know, do what the French do, which is go to the market and cook stuff.
Yeah, no, and I think that's a great point, because that actually is the way most French people eat all the time. And that, I don't know statistically, but I'm pretty sure that the amount of disposable income the French have, the average French family compared to American, is not as high. So eating out or splurging on expensive wine or good meals is more rare than it is day to day.
The median French income is somewhere around 21,000 euros a year. So if anyone wants to like do the math on that, and, you know, remember, like, they're paying very high taxes, but they also pay for no healthcare. You know, healthcare is taken care of. Lots of things are taken care of. But yeah, it's, you know, it is not a place with particularly high salaries. Labor there is very stable, in that you're likely to keep the job, but there's not tons of advancement. And so, yeah, honestly, it's astonishing the French dine out as much as they do, which is, I think, a testament to how important that is in the French culture, given that, you know, we show up in Paris and we think everything is so affordable and it's so great and you can dine out all the time. But the typical French person is doing that on a much smaller salary.
Yeah. All right. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll hear John's Julia moment. Tickets are on sale for the 2023 Taste of Santa Barbara, May 15th to 21st. Check out the full schedule and get your tickets now on sbce.events. The lineup features some of Santa Barbara County's top culinary talent. Highlights include a special screening of classic Julia episodes and a conversation with chefs Susan Feniger, Antonio Lafazo, and Nancy Silverton. A cherry bomb meetup focused on women winemakers at the Inn at Maddie's Tavern, and the Taste of Santa Barbara Wines at El Presidio returns. There will be cooking classes, farm tours, wine tours, and special menus throughout the county. Follow at SB Culinary Experience on Instagram for breaking news and updates. Proceeds from the Taste of Santa Barbara benefit the local community. We hope to see you there. Let us know what you think of today's show. Send us an email or a voice memo to contact@juliachildfoundation.org. We'll be right back.
When you flip anything, you just have to have the courage of your convictions, particularly if it's sort of a loose mess like this. No, that didn't go very well. See, when I flipped it, I didn't have the courage to do it the way I should have. But you can always pick it up, and if you're alone in the kitchen, who is going to see?
From Julia's immortal words, we move into our last segment, which we call the Julia moment. Here's when we ask our guests to share their favorite Julia memory, moment, or how she might have inspired them in their career. John, what's your Julia moment?
So I don't know that I have a really great single defining moment. What I will say is this. So my father had an interesting career. He trained both in business. He was a businessman and a corporate executive, but he also trained as a chef. And so growing up was interesting because there was a lot of very osmotic learning in our house where you just sort of hang out in the kitchen and watch him do stuff. And I will say that his prime cookbook was Mastering the Art of French Cooking. I think he actually had a first edition of it. And so Julia was sort of there, always lurking whenever I was watching my father do whatever he was doing, roast chicken, do a gratin, et cetera. I still have that book, and it's to say it's tattered is being kind. But I will say that, you know, her work and clearly her ethos and that moment, I'd say, in the 60s into the early 70s, when she was really guiding Americans to understand what true French cooking was, I just happened to kind of, you know, pick it up by hanging around.
I love that. I think that's great. We love those very personal family Julia moments, and I know that Julia would have too. Thank you for sharing that.
Of course. So it's like I wish I had one big recipe, but this is kind of the same with my wine career. It's just, you know, you hang around with, you know, talented people long enough, eventually you pick something up.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today.
Todd, truly a pleasure.
And thanks everyone for listening. For more from John, he's at Jbonne, J-B-O-N-N-E, on Twitter and Instagram. The book is The New French Wine, Redefining the World's Greatest Wine Culture by John Bonnet, with photographs by Susanna Ireland. It's out now from 10 Speed Press. Ask or search for it at your favorite bookseller. Video clips from The French Chef continue to arrive weekly on at Julia Child on Facebook. And please follow at Julia Child Foundation on Instagram. I'm at T. Shulkin on Instagram. You can find Julia Child channels streaming The French Chef on Pluto TV, Plex, and Freevee, as well as on the PBS Living and PBS Documentary channels on Amazon. The Julia Child audio clip from The French Chef is used with permission from our friends at GBH. Thanks to my co-producer at the Foundation, Lauren Salkeld, and our sound engineer at Heritage Radio Network, Armin Spengen. Our theme song is New French Horn by Novi Valtorni. We're on the air on Heritage Radio Network on Thursdays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, with downloads available soon after wherever you find your podcasts. We look forward to bringing you back into the Foundation's world next time on Inside Julia's Kitchen. Inside Julia's Kitchen is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.